It's Friday. It's the end of the work week for some. And for us, it's the weekly news roundup. Welcome. Thanks for being a part of the full story. I'm Ron Ropiak, and my thanks to Becky for filling in yesterday while I got over a summer bug. Hate those things. There should be a repellent. No summer bugs. But I did have some time while I was resting on the couch to go over some of the emails that you sent in recently. Thank you for them. All of them, both good and bad. And we always want to know what you think. Your thoughts about a show or questions you may have for a guest. You can always reach us at tfs@wshu.org, or you can find us on Facebook at Full Story WSHU. And I should mention that I'll be reading some of the emails later on in the broadcast. Now, let's bring in our guest. Ken Dixon is here with me in the studio. Ken writes for Hearst Connecticut Media, and he does it so well that he's a member of the Connecticut Journalism Hall of Fame. Sue Haig joins us on the phone from Hartford, where she covers the state capitol for the Associated Press. And Russell Blair is joining us for our first segment today. Russell writes for the Hartford Current, and he's been writing about Connecticut's so-called red flag laws and how that may help the entire country when it comes to these sickening mass shootings that we're all so angry about. Welcome all. It's good to have everybody. And Russell, thanks for your time.
Yeah, great to be here.
Russell, what's a red flag law?
So essentially, this is a law where it allows for a court to intervene, a judge to have an order where somebody's firearms are taken away from them rather quickly if they're deemed to be a danger to themselves or others. In some cases, there's court hearings that follow up. But the key thing here is this is a way that law enforcement can act quickly, and they can take guns away from somebody if police or family members or a coworker or somebody believes that this person has access to weapons and they pose a danger, an immediate risk, and something needs to be done quickly.
How long has Connecticut had this law?
Connecticut's law dates back to the 1999 mass shooting at the Connecticut Lottery. And after the shooting, there was a lot of consideration of, different steps that could be taken. And this was one thing that came up because at the time, people said colleagues knew that the gunman in that case, had access to guns and that there were some things that were concerning. But there wasn't really a quick intervention to go in and seek to have the guns removed without, going through a long and drawn out process or without getting somebody committed to a psychiatric hospital. There was not a quick way where you could say, I believe this person poses a danger and should not have access to guns. And is there a way to quickly move on this without, drawing this out for weeks or months?
Ken, how many states have red flag laws?
Ron, I don't know. Ask me something I know. Cut it out.
I do know, like 10, Sue?
What do you think?
I can butt in. I know that. There's like only a handful of them. I think it was California, Washington, Oregon, and Indiana. That was as of 2018.
And Connecticut was the first?
Yes.
I'm not sure if we were the first, honestly.
Okay. So, Russell, from your research and your reporting, from what you've seen, what is the opposition to other states adopting this?
I think we've seen a growing number looking and considering it. I think the opposition has always been the due process argument that, the Second Amendment is right there. There's a right for people to keep and bear arms. And how do you weigh that against, the potential risk that they might face? And I think the pushback that we've seen is from gun owners who say, somebody should have a chance in a courtroom to say, look, I am competent. I should have access to my guns. I don't pose a risk. And what this does is this sort of takes the person's guns away before there is that opportunity for the hearing. And then you have the hearing. And then, presumably, if you make your case strong enough, your guns would be returned to you. But I think there's a real feeling among Second Amendment supporters and gun owners that, it should be the other way around. There should be a court hearing and a judge makes a decision about whether or not you can have the guns rather than taking the guns away and then deciding whether or not you get them back.
This was a bipartisan bill in 1999 signed by Republican Governor Roland, came out of the Judiciary Committee. It was criticized as take your guns away from your neighbor, but in fact police make a call about whether somebody's in crisis when they talk to them. Two officers show up at the house or wherever. Most of the time, you have to get somebody to the hospital to submit to a psychiatric exam, and that's an automatic 2-week removal of firearms. And I think it saved many lives. There have been well over 1,000 cases, multiple guns being taken away. Some people agree to just surrender them entirely, and they end up getting destroyed. And they have counseling, and they're over the crisis immediately.
Sue, in terms of what the legislature does in terms of strengthening this for the future, have you heard anything in the last session as to whether or not this will be amended, strengthened, or do the legislators pretty much like how it's operating, how it's working currently?
No, there hasn't really been talk about that. I mean, the last session, primarily, they focused on safe gun storage. And the thing that really actually seems to be popping up statewide is Matt Ritter, the majority leader in the House. He wants lawmakers to take a look at possibly joining forces with other states to have a request a constitutional convention to amend the U.S. Constitution to ban assault-style firearms. So that's, it seems to be this consensus that we've done a lot already here in Connecticut, and what we need to do is to try to either get something done in other states or somehow put pressure on Washington to follow Connecticut's lead.
I saw that story the other day about Matt Ritter, and basically once it came out, I believe he said, I'm not going to pursue this. As a matter of fact, I'm never going to bring this up again because no one knows actually what would happen at a constitutional convention. It could open up a whole can of worms, and some scholars have said it's a dangerous thing. Russell, where does this go now on the national level? When you look at it, I know Senator Blumenthal from Connecticut has been talking about this with Senator Graham. Any chance of something like we have in Connecticut going to a national model?
I think what we're looking at here is there was actually a bill after the Parkland shooting last year where it was Blumenthal and Graham working on something, but that didn't get much traction. This time around, Trump has come out and said, you know, this is something that he might be able to support. So I think that gives it a little bit of movement. It would be a kind of a grant program where there would be money or other incentives to states that would try to get them to enact this law. So not necessarily, you know, a thing where FBI agents are going to be the ones, you know, enforcing this, but that, you know, the Department of Justice would hand out money to states that have these kind of programs where, you know, there's an intervention where somebody can petition the court for this and police officers can go in and take those weapons away. And so Senator Blumenthal said, you know, him and Lindsey Graham are working on this. They're going to release the text of it sometime soon. And again, I think Trump saying, you know, this seems like something he could support might get some more Republicans to consider it than, you know, the last time around.
Ken, every time we have one of these horrific stories, it always captivates the news for the next number of days after it occurs. Then the questions always come up. Is this the tipping point?
Right.
Will legislation finally... Is it a game changer? Do you see anything here that makes this a game changer?
I think it's the same old story in the Senate. I mean, we'll be lucky if they can agree on a bill for the background checks. McConnell was saying that he'll bring people back, not during their vaunted break, though. You know, when they come back in September, maybe they'll do something.
Sue, anything from the Hartford perspective as to whether or not this is a change, a game changer?
I sensed at a rally this week that there's frustration that they keep thinking that, you know, it would be a game changer after Sandy Hook. And, you know, 7 years have gone by and nothing has happened. And there is this concern that people might be sort of bummed out by this and not want to work towards something. That's something that, that's why Matt Ritter had brought up that whole idea about trying to get a constitutional convention. But the advocates say there is momentum. They say that state laws seem to be the where the progress has been made if you're for these for this legislation. And they brought up at this rally there seem to be more members of that Mothers Against Gun Violence group than there are NRA members. I don't know if that's accurate or not, but there's people like Blumenthal and Murphy. They're trying to say that there is momentum on their side, and this stuff just takes time.
And again, unfortunately, just like with climate change proposals, some states say, look, if we do it in our state and someone in the next state isn't doing anything, what good is it going to do? If it's going to be done, it has to be done on a regional level, or it has to be done on a national level to really have an effect for everyone, a good effect for everyone. Russell Blair from the Hartford Courant. Thanks, Russell. We appreciate your time. Please come back
with us.
All right. Ken is going to stay with us, Ken Dixon. Sue Haig is going to stay with us. And when we come back, we're going to be joined by Anna Radelet. But if you'd like to comment on today's program, you can email us. We're at tfs@wshu.org. On Twitter, you can find us at FullStoryWSHU. And remember, all of our shows are available as podcasts. You can download the full story on Google Play, or you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. One more time, the email address is tfs@wshu.org. We'll take a short break. Back in just a moment. It's the weekly news roundup on The Full Story. I'm Ron Robiak. As always, I thank you for being part of our show today. For the next 20 minutes or so, Ken Dixon is with us from Hearst, Connecticut Media, Sue Haig from the Associated Press, and joining us from D.C. is Anna Radelet, who writes for ConnecticutMirror.org, ctmirror.org. Hi, Anna. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. You had a report the other day about John Larson. Now, the Connecticut congressman has been in the national news recently because he's trying to save Social Security, and he's taking some heat for some parts of his proposal because taxes are going to go up. But as you wrote, Anna, the congressman is also taking heat because of something he's not doing. Tell us more, please.
Yes, Congressman Larson is about one of 110 or 115 House members who do not support beginning impeachment proceedings or impeaching President Trump. And they're taking heat for it. The people who, the House Democrats who are not supportive of impeaching Donald Trump are going back to their districts in the August break and finding some of their constituents upset about it. They're getting phone calls, or as Congressman Larson found when he held a town hall the other night, they're getting a lot of pushback from people who are angry that they're not joining what's now a majority of House members, just by a few members, I guess. It's about 120 House members who support beginning impeachment proceedings or sending articles of impeachment right away to the Senate.
One of the lines in your story that really jumped out at me was when one of the constituents said to the congressman, you read the Mueller report. How can you read that and then not be for impeaching Donald Trump? What was the congressman's comeback?
Well, he and those who don't support impeachment, and the leader of this movement, of course, is the House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, say they have to be very careful. They want to investigate more. They have a series of investigations. There are at least three congressional committees that are doing separate investigations of the president, and they feel, they're issuing subpoenas like jelly beans. They're issuing a lot of subpoenas. I don't mean to be, trite about that, but and they feel that they need to investigate, let the committees investigate, and allow the House of Representatives to do its work passing bills on important issues. They know that the Senate-controlled, the Republican-controlled Senate will not, you know, will not vote to, you know, to condemn the president, to impeach the president. So they feel spending House time on something that will not pan out and the removal of the president from office is not a good use of time.
So Jim Himes was with us a few weeks back. He's the 4th District Congressman, and he wants an impeachment inquiry into the president. Not impeachment. He says he wants an inquiry right now. So how are the other three in the Connecticut delegation approaching this debate?
He wants an impeachment inquiry. Rosa DeLauro wants the inquiries that are happening right now, which, by the way, some Democrats, to avoid heat, say are actually an unofficial impeachment inquiry. And so Joe Courtney is also on board with the status quo. So is, of course, Larson, as we saw. Johanna Hayes is also, but she says she's considering, the option of impeachment, that it's not off the table. And she, you know, like many Democrats who are not in favor of impeachment, she's getting a pushback from her constituents.
I know I only have you for a short time today, so I just want to ask you this quick question, because I was thinking about this when I was watching the last Democratic presidential debate. And it goes back to a story that you wrote a few months ago, which we, you and I, never really had a chance to talk about. It's about Connecticut U.S. Senator Chris Murphy and the impact that he's having on foreign policy. Could you tell us a little bit more about it?
Yes, I think Chris Murphy, who's a member of the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee, has staked out some ground for himself in promoting certain foreign policy initiatives. Most, you know, he's been most successful, I guess if you can call, getting bills passed through the House and Senate and vetoed by the president, but he has been able to win support in the House and Senate amongst Democrats and Republicans on the issue of banning some arms to Saudi Arabia, which are used in its battle with in Syria. So, you know, he has been successful. He has been outspoken. He makes the circuit of all the foreign policy, you know, organizations, shops here in D.C. He writes a lot of op-eds on the issue. And, you know, he's kind of taken over the role that Chris Dodd used to take in foreign policy.
And just with the final question for you, some have indicated that they think that this is actually a precursor or preview, if you will, of Chris Murphy running for president, not soon, obviously, but all the way in the future. I mean, we're talking 2024.
You know, every senator is ambitious. And I think in the back of almost every senator's mind is hopeful White House run. So I'm not going to take that away from Senator Murphy. I don't know what's in his head, but, you know, he is young, very young. He is ambitious, and he's an aggressive politician. We can see it on his, you know, his campaigns for health care and gun control, too.
Anna Radelet, you can read all her columns, ctmirror.org. Anna, always a pleasure. Thank you. I hope you have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you. You too.
Be well. Ken Dixon still with us. Sue Haig still with us for another 10 minutes or so. Ken, Sue, with the remaining time, can we concentrate on three stories, if you don't mind? I don't know which one wants to take this first. It's the it's almost like the toll story. We talk about it every week. Ken, what's the latest with the gambling situation in Connecticut?
Oh, Ron, really? What do you want?
I know I get that reaction.
Anything you want.
We can talk about tolls.
Yeah, you could. Well, yeah, let's put tolls up there in East Windsor because they would probably go up before anything. It's like MGM files another lawsuit. That's their business is protecting their billion-dollar operation in Springfield. And then they, the two tribes, they show us the little shiny object about, oh, we'll put some little betting parlor in Bridgeport worth a mere $100 million. How about that, Sue?
Very concise. Yeah, you know, MGM, they filed a lawsuit in Washington, D.C. this week. They want to overturn the Department of Interior's approval earlier this year in March of these amendments to the gambling agreements between Connecticut and the tribes that that ultimately allow them to own to operate the East Windsor Casino, which still has not, I don't think they've actually begun building it. I think they're still trying to get financing for it. But they're saying that these approvals violate the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, and it creates this unlawful monopoly. So this could stretch out for a while. I'm not sure if it's going to delay that casino actually opening up in East Windsor. The tribes have said before they expected the MGM to sue, and they said that they have faced lawsuits in the past and kept working through them on other projects. So we'll see if this actually will delay it even further.
Are we going to be talking about this story this time next year?
I think we should get the pool going now, Ron. What's gonna happen first?
I don't know. Toss up right now. It can go either direction.
Yeah, I mean, this thing won't be built in East Windsor by next year. So yeah, I think next year it'll probably come up again. And then you still have this push to try to by some lawmakers who want to give the tribes the ability to provide sports betting, and that's a, you know, and then Governor Lamont, God, I can't stop saying Malloy. Governor Lamont wants to have like some sort of a grand bargain. We've talked about this before, that might satisfy MGM and persuade them not to sue. But obviously, they are suing in this situation.
All right, second story, second of the three, Ray Dalio, the billionaire, the Greenwich billionaire, worth about $17 to $18 billion. He wants to give $100 million to Connecticut for educational purposes. With money from the state and from private donations, they're looking to get about $300 million. But Ken, this has been controversial from the get-go. Why?
The provision that the state has to have some skin in the game, for starters, that became a budgetary issue during the session. Most recently, the state attorney general has ruled that any elected official on that board of the is subject to freedom of information. So that's at least good news, because this law was written to exempt it from the State Freedom of Information Act. And the typical private hedge fund, the Dalio thought that it was more convenient to work in secret, and there's going to be less of that, mercifully.
Sue, some were surprised because Ray Dalio has built a good chunk of his reputation on the fact of that the proceedings, the information gathering at his firm, which is the largest hedge fund firm in the world, that they stress transparency and honesty and really letting people what you know about their ideas. And so some have looked at this and they've said, well, if you do it in the private sector, why aren't we doing it here?
I actually interviewed his wife, Barbara Dalio. She leads their foundation's public education efforts. And she said that she does understand why there are concerns that this board that's going to be overseeing this money is not subject to FOI. But she's made the argument that this would allow people to feel more comfortable about disagreeing and coming to consensus. And she says they have operated this way in the past, and that they have always provided information about their work to the public. But this is the first time that they've actually operated with a partnership with the state involving state money. And that's like the real issue here that's been raised by some lawmakers, by open government advocates. They've questioned, you know, this is fulfilling ultimately some sort of a public need, a public function. It's been kind of broadly described as they're going to be focusing on communities with disengaged youth and providing greater economic opportunity, but it's been kind of vague, and so people want to know what exactly is this money going to be spent on. And they put these lawmakers in sort of a weird position, because you've got this board that's made up with these legislators who are elected, and then you've got appointees that are appointed by Dalio, and then you have appointees appointed by the governor, and the lawmakers now they're going to be the ones that are subject to FOI, but everybody else isn't. So that means the documents the lawmakers get, they have to turn over if I put in an FOI request, but the other guys don't have to. So it's sort of in a weird situation right now as to what's going to happen going forward.
Ken, one last question about this. The opinion from the Attorney General, William Tong, is that now binding?
He left it open for the Freedom of Information Commission to chime in on it eventually, but Themis Claridis, the House Minority Leader, asked for the opinion, and I'm sure, I haven't talked to her this week, but I'm sure that it assuages her somewhat.
And finally, our last story, Sue, you had an interesting story which came out just yesterday, and it was about our governor, Ned Lamont, who obviously comes from the private sector, and before being governor, he was the selectman in Greenwich. That was it. That was his political background. So he really knows the private sector well. And if you could pick it up from here, please.
Yeah, he sort of made a pitch during the campaign to reach out to business people. And I regularly FOI the schedules of the governors. I FOI'd Malloy's as well. And so I looked at the schedules for the last 6 months, and I just was kind of surprised. I mean, there were just at least four dozen top executives that he has either met with or talked to on the phone. And I've found out that he sort of has like this three-pronged approach. It's either some of these calls had to do with a specific piece of legislation that's for the legislature, but also I'd say the bulk of them are more of these get-to-know-you type of conversations. And Lamont's been very wary of being broadsided like Malloy was when GE left the state. So the thought is that he can develop this rapport. Maybe they'll give him a heads up if they're having issues. Maybe there's something that the administration can do. And he also wants to try to mesh public policy better to the needs of businesses in order to promote job growth in the state. So it's multi-pronged, but he has been doing a lot of this behind the scenes that I don't think a lot of people were aware of.
Ken, is this part of the public-private partnership that the governor has been pushing for since before he became governor? And this was part of his campaign platform. Or is this just what governors have to do? They have to go out and they have to press the flesh.
Well, you have to do what you know, and Ned Lamont has got all this private sector experience and very, very little governmental experience. So he's probably trying to pick their brains too. I don't know if he's trying to pitch them on donating funding to the that Dalio effort.
Need to raise $100 million from the private sector.
Yeah. I mean, the thing I would ask Sue is whether Ned Lamont was easier to obtain a schedule from than his predecessor. What do you think about that?
I was able to get Malloy's, but I have to say there's a lot more on Lamont's schedules that is provided to me than was on Malloy's. It was interesting. I was surprised how packed his schedule is and how much stuff is on there. And then there's stuff I found out, too, that he does this also. He has just sort of like these spur-of-the-moment visits, too. Like I talk to these guys that run a brew house and a brew pub or a brewery, I guess, in Chester. And he just, like, they were closed for production, and he just stopped by and wanted to talk to them. And everybody that I talked to said he asks a lot of questions. He's not lecturing. He's asking a lot of questions, wanting to know what they need to be competitive.
The questions weren't, is the lager better? Is the stout better?
did have a lager.
Well, good
for him. I did find that out. And he drank it all. The guy was happy, so he figured he must have liked it because he finished it.
Sue Haig covers the state capitol and more for the Associated Press. And Mr. Ken Dixon writes for Hearst Connecticut Media, and he's off to do his column right now.
The governor has a driver, by the way.
He does have a driver. Good man for that.
Yes, yes.
Thank you, Sue. Have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you. You too, Ron.
Speak with you soon. Thanks, Kenny. Appreciate it.
Okay, Ron.
If you want to join in by email, you can TFS us, tfs@wshu.org. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. It's the full story on WSHU, and just as a reminder, coming up in just a bit, I'm going to be reading some of the emails that we received here in the last week. That'll be near the end of our program today. Now, you probably know that ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, conducted a raid in Mississippi the other day. About 700 undocumented immigrants were taken into custody. From the reports that I saw earlier today, a few hundred have been released on what's called humanitarian grounds. The question is, what will the effect of these raids have on our region? And obviously, some are just scared, and they've been scared for a while. Victor Manuel Ramos is a staff writer at Newsday. Yancey Roy is Newsday's Albany bureau chief. They've been writing about this for a while now. Victor, Yancey, thanks for coming on today. We appreciate your time.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Victor, what are you hearing from the immigrant community after these raids?
Well, as you mentioned, even before the raids, people in immigrant communities on Long Island had been living in a climate of fear that had been spurred by the not only the policies of the current administration, but the political rhetoric surrounding the implementation of those policies. And there had been many rumors and days of panic where people believed that ICE was conducting operations in the region and went in hiding or avoided the normal activities that they pursued throughout their days. And many of those proved to be false, but the events of the last week or two have kind of brought that home in the sense that, you know, they weren't necessarily just baseless rumors. There is a push to implement the policies of the current administration that that has many people scared. And, you know, in monitoring that conversation, I have seen that advocacy groups in the region have been reaching out to immigrants here to guide them through this and try to prevent panic, but people have reasons to believe that they could be next. And even though the operation in Mississippi is kind of unusual, it's not your typical immigration operation. They normally aren't as massive raids as this one, which is considered one of the maybe the largest to date. ICE has been operating in the region and has stepped up enforcement through the first years of the Trump administration, not only pursuing more detention and arrest, but also changing who is targeted in those operations.
Yancey, what's the reaction in Albany and from the Cuomo administration?
Well, the Cuomo administration has been very vocal in opposing the Trump priorities in terms of how ICE operates and just the overall sort of viewpoint of how to treat people. I think, you know, any of us who have covered Governor Cuomo for some time have known he goes into the sort of his standard speech on this, which is to say, I am from immigrants, we are all from immigrants. And try to push that broader perspective and his viewpoint out there. I think that to some extent they have limited opportunities to combat this. They certainly have the bully pulpit. There's certainly some other things they can do. Like, for example, one of the pieces of legislation passed the last week of the legislative session here was about certain types of crimes. And without getting into all of the weeds, the important thing here was they changed some types of crimes so that instead of saying that the penalty could be 1 year, it was actually 364 days. And now why is that important? Because if a crime was 364 days or less, then the person who's convicted would not be subject to a deportation proceeding. So they've used the bully pulpit. They've you know, worked around the edges, like I say, with doing such things as changing sentences and laws so as to not expose people to deportation. But, you know, they are a little bit limited in how much they can oppose the administration.
Victor, from your excellent report, and I encourage everyone to read it. I believe it came out back in June, and you could find it online at newsday.com. You reported that there are many who are simply afraid to leave their homes nowadays. They won't get out of the house, and they won't even drive because they're afraid that if they make a wrong turn or if they don't signal, they'll be pulled over, and that's that. And so they're walking everywhere. The climate of fear is something that is so profound, isn't it?
Yeah, I think, you know, what are simple acts to most people become a reason for concern for those who feel that they are being targeted by the policies of the current administration. And I'll give you one example. We featured a Guatemalan immigrant in the story we had looking at the climate of fear on Long Island, who told me that around the time when her husband came home every day, they would go quiet in her home, that she had prepared the children, including the little ones, to know, you know, if you hear someone at the door, don't go and open it. Because usually the little children want to run to the door to welcome their dad. And in her mind, she thought, well, it could be someone else. It could be ICE. They could come looking for us, or they could come looking for someone else and find us. And this was an everyday issue for them. Now, that doesn't mean that immigrants are not going out and working and doing the things they need to do. But there are sort of waves of panic that move through the population where there's a rumor that someone saw an ICE officer at a particular location. Or there was even one instance where there was a cargo van parked outside a Hispanic evangelical church. You know, people were afraid to come out of the church or to go to the church. It turned out to be nothing. But, you know, as I said, the what's happened this week shows that it could be something. And it's difficult for people to leave, you know, go about their everyday business with that uncertainty, because what's at stake is that you know, you have mixed status families where the children may have been born in the United States and either one or both parents you know, came here illegally or stayed when their papers expired, and you know, they have to consider whether, you know, they, if they are detained and removed, what's going to happen to their children? You know, do they stay here? Do they have arrangements for someone to pick them up? Do they leave them behind because it's better for them to live in the United States, their country of birth? Or, you know, do they take them with them back to the places they fled?
Yancy, I only have 45 seconds left, but just one last question, if I can. What about those who employ the undocumented immigrants? Have you or anyone from Newsday been able to speak with any of them?
You know, Victor has been covering most of that for us. I haven't. You know, it's a good question as to why are the employers not targeted. But I also jump ahead just a little bit to say about Cuomo. You know, it's going to be interesting also to see how they fight over information about driver's license. You know, whether New York signed a law that would allow undocumented immigrants to get licenses. There's been a fear as to whether ICE would try to access that information. What the Cuomo administration's position will be and how it fights on that question, if it emerges, could also be a pretty telling factor.
Victor, I'm going to get you back in the near future, and we'll talk about what's going on in regards to maybe getting in some of the employers who hire the undocumented immigrants, even on the air with us. And I'd love to hear your reporting on that. Yancey Roy, Newsday's Albany Bureau Chief. Victor Manuel Ramos, staff writer at Newsday. Victor, Yancey, thank you. I hope you have a nice weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you both. With the short time we have left now, I'm going to call on WSHU's J.D. Allen. He's here in the studio with me to talk about two stories. The first, which we've covered in the past, it concerns that proposed $1.3 billion arena and entertainment complex at Belmont Park. J.D., what's the latest?
Well, it got a big thumbs up from the state agency yesterday afternoon. So that approves the 19,000-seat arena with 350,000 square feet of upscale shops and restaurants and a 250-room hotel at Belmont Park right there in Nassau County. You know, probably for the sports fans out there, it means the Islanders are coming back to Long Island, back to Nassau County, which, you know, hockey fans are very excited about. But on the lawmaker side of things, they're really excited about the economic boon that this is going to bring. It's an estimated 3,200 jobs and a whole lot of economic growth that goes with it.
In the past, opponents of the development told us they were very concerned about the impact that this is going to have on the community. Were their concerns addressed adequately?
So this was a very, very long process to go through the development rights and procedure in New York is a lengthy process, whether or not you're putting up a house or if you're putting up a giant arena. The process is more or less the same. What the complaints from environmentalists and from neighbors had to do with more traffic congestion, sewer upgrades that were going to be needed. So that way, this giant hunk of concrete and metal and activity didn't, you know, disturb groundwater, didn't disturb commutes, didn't disturb neighbors who live in that area.
And I should mention that if everything goes according to schedule, they're saying that the new Islanders Arena will be open fall of 2021.
That's what it looks like, and with that also comes a full-time Long Island Railroad station right there on the north end of the parking lot, which will serve not only the arena but also the community of Elmont around it, which they've been calling for years.
Because nobody wants to be driving on the Cross Island. Almost at any time. It's like as bad as driving on the Van Wyck. Finally, I want to touch on a story that came out yesterday. This comes after our program on Lyme disease the other week. We talked about Lyme disease. We talked about ticks on it, and it generated a lot of comments. Now, Suffolk County health officials say that a local mosquito sample has tested positive for a rare and possibly deadly virus. It's called Eastern Equine Encephalitis, EEE, JD?
EEE is way easier to say.
Yes,
EEE has the potential to cause a fatal brain swelling in humans if bit by a mosquito that carries it. However, that's incredibly rare. It is uncommon in humans, and there's only been like 7 reported cases on average in the United States, and no reported history of it in Suffolk County in terms of infection. It does go after, however, horses. Horses tend to be the ones that are affected more often than not, but still to have this virus in your backyard is a concern. So what Suffolk County did is that it asked Suffolk County health officials asked the state to declare this as an emergency so that way they can be able to ramp up their mosquito and vector-borne disease prevention.
I know that after our program the other week about Lyme disease, I received a number of emails and phone calls from those who are very concerned about what is going on in our region. And it wasn't to stoke fears, but at the same time, those who were listening contacted me and they said, thank you for the reminder. And when we go out, use repellent, wear long sleeves, wear long pants.
The bugs are here, and they're going to be here because of rising temperatures and not as cold winters. And it's even surprising for mosquitoes to kind of even still be around at this point in the summer. The season for them is usually between July and August, but folks are saying that, scientists are saying that they're going, this presence that they have is going to exist further into September because of the temperatures.
Is there any word as to when the state will actually say, yes, this is an emergency?
I believe they're reviewing it now, and we should hear something soon.
WSHU's JD Allen. Thanks, you, JD. On Friday, we like to spend a few minutes reading some of the emails that we received during the week. Here are excerpts from a few of them. The first is from Sean in Flanders, and his email goes back to our weekly news roundup last Friday, where JD and I spoke about the effort in Suffolk County to transition from its reliance on traditional cesspools and septic systems, which would reduce the amount of nitrogen that's leaked into the environment. And Sean wrote us this. Ron, your topics are striking a chord with me. Alternative septic technology has been around and in use in Massachusetts and Rhode Island for decades now. I can never figure out why Suffolk County was opposed to their use, considering how bad the water quality of the local bays and estuaries have been getting. Anyway, like I said, I'm glad they're allowing the use of alternative sanitary systems. I just wonder what took so long. On one of our shows, we spoke about that new plastic bag law that went into effect in Connecticut the other week, and Patty wrote, I'm a Suffolk County resident, and I can assure you that you will get used to bringing your own bag into the store. There was a lot, and I mean a lot of pushback at first, but people get used to it. Louis Rosado Birch, the Connecticut Program Director for Citizens Campaign for the Environment, sent this to us after hearing the discussion. The language that would have passed in the budget was fraught with loopholes, and it would have done little to eliminate plastic bags in our state in the long term. What your guest failed to explain was that the Connecticut bag law is a true grassroots victory, involving thousands of citizen activists from all over the state signing petitions, writing letters, and sending emails to their elected officials urging them to make this happen. One listener had this comment and question recently. I saw on Facebook how President Trump is selling plastic straws with his name on them for $15 a pack, $1 each. I wondered if your guest might give his opinion as to the lack of understanding on many people's parts about plastic waste in our landfills and in our oceans. And on Wednesday, we had a repeat broadcast of a show we did a few weeks back about political discourse in 2019 and how big of a divide there is, or is this just being exaggerated? And Tom wrote, hi, Ron, on the program yesterday, you had Republican politicians who described the Democrats as radical and a major departure from previous Democratic politicians. I don't think that's the case. And without asking the Republicans what issues they think their opponents are radical on, it's a meaningless slam against their peers. Your emails are always welcome. Please drop them in the mail with proper postage to tfs@wshu.org. On Twitter, find us on Full Story WSHU. And please remember that all our shows are available as podcasts. You can download the full story on Google Play or on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. That's going to do it for our show today. Julie Ferdino is our engineer. Carrie Frank is the digital editor. Our associate producers are Christian Carter, Sabrina Garone, Natalie Chafari. J.D. Allen sits across from me, and he's also the producer. Ann Lopez is the senior producer, and Terry Sheridan is our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. I hope you have a wonderful weekend, and thanks to you for being part of The Full Story.